In the introduction to her new book, Peg Tyre quotes a dad frustrated by the process of choosing a school. Quote, "It's absurd. When you purchase a house, you get an inspector's report. When you buy a sports car, at least you get to check under the hood. But now we are trying to do something that matters 1,000 times more to our family than buying a house or purchasing a car. And what happens? We're expected to attend the open house, shake hands with the principal, blindly enroll them, and have faith that everything will turn out all right. We don't even get to look under the hood." In The Good School, Tyre, a former Newsweek reporter and author of a best-selling book on boys, offers a look under the hood for harried parents worried about getting their children a top-notch education. Today, we'll talk with Tyre about parents' concerns, the advice she gives them, and why it matters. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Joining us via Skype. Welcome to the show.
Oh, nice to be here.
Okay. Well, as I told you beforehand, I'm excited about this interview, both because it's a great book and because I'm a parent of young children. And so I read that with an eye towards that. And my wife and I are trying to sort through all of these issues right now. So tell us, why this book? What inspired this particular book for you?
I've covered education for a long time, and I've had the opportunity to look at a lot of research. And so often, about 10 pages into a piece of arcane academic writing, I found a real nugget. And I've slapped myself on the forehead and thought, gosh, I wish I knew this when I was making decisions for my own child. And so I see that school choice is a very important lever in education reform, and I worry that parents don't have the information they need to actually choose schools well. So I tried to write this book to condense a lot of research in a way that's accessible to parents.
Who would you say the audience is for this, Peg? Who's most likely to read this book?
Well, I have the audience that I wrote it for is basically you. It's parents of young children, school-aged children. I think I wrote a special section for parents who are looking at the preschool years because there is no one more anxious and there is no one more focused on doing the right thing. You just have more time to think about doing the right thing when they're very young, especially first child. And so I have a special section for preschool choice. And then I wrote the rest of the book with parents of school-aged children K through 8 in mind.
Mm-hmm. You know, I noticed throughout the book this is something that it seems like you struggled with, and it's a tough challenge, which is that on the one hand, there might be certain lessons that poor families in particular need to heed, and others that are going to apply more to upper-middle-class parents, that perhaps what kids from those different social groups need is something different. Would you say that's true?
That's totally true. And the conceit of what I did in this book and that in the boys' book is that we're all the same and that we all need the same thing. And if you know the research, if you're thinking about education or working in education, you know that's not true. However, I've worked in the media long enough to know that it's very, very difficult to write about low-income families and get it in the mainstream media. So in a way, a lot of things I do are a stalking horse to like plant ideas in the mainstream media with the hope that there's a trickle down to low-income parents who by and large have very little access to information, to high quality information.
Now, on the other hand, a lot of the research that you point to, it seems like research was done with poor kids. And so research saying this is kind of intervention works well for poor kids. How do you translate that necessarily for more affluent families?
Super difficult. And at times in the book, I'd say, well, here's the study group and here's it was low income kids and here's the results. And parents and sometimes I say, and so if you are a low income parent or you're a parent of a poor African-American boy, which is the same as the study group, then, you know, you can draw an apples to apples comparison. And then there's times, for example, in class size, a chapter on class size, when I say, but this is the group they studied and this may not apply to you. So I try, you know, you try and slice it and dice it in a way. Interestingly, in American life, people get very offended when you talk about income level. And in fact, in my experience as a reporter, in a couple of decades as a reporter, I've met very few people who consider themselves low income. If you ask almost anyone, they'll tell you that they're middle class. If they're redeeming cans, if they're opening your garbage bags and redeeming the bottles and cans out of your garbage can, those people will still tell you they're pretty much middle class. So it's real. It's an interesting dynamic in American culture to get people to self-identify as even working class in our culture.
That's interesting. So let's assume that a lot of the people reading this book are going to be fairly affluent, well-educated. You talk about how the people raising children today are better educated than any generation before. More of us have gone to college, advanced degrees, all of that. And, you know, the audience seems to be people who are anxious about whether or not they're doing right by their kids. One answer to those parents could be, relax, your kids will be fine. But that's not really the message of your book. How come?
Well, you know, it's interesting, but what I see in a lot of middle class communities is a kind of fat and happy attitude of like, you know, the schools are fine. We pay a lot in real estate taxes, and so our schools are fine. And that's not exactly how it looks in a lot of middle class communities. A lot of public schools in middle class communities are highly variable. We know that in many Norwalk, Connecticut, for instance, where it's not uncommon to pay $1.5 million for a pretty regular house, the schools there are really variable and do not do particularly well, and do not do particularly well by Connecticut standards, which we all know are pretty low, especially around reading. And so my hope is that parents can, and also I think very hard about the fact that what was good for what created reputations is often what was good for kids 20 years ago, and that our needs for an educated populace are really changing. Like, we really don't know what to do with kids who don't get more than post-secondary education. So our goals are moving, our goalposts are moving in a way that I think parents are slow to grasp.
Right. So this is the international competitiveness argument that says, look, you know, policy wonks, policymakers, they want parents to ask for more, make sure that all kids are getting on that track for international competitiveness. Does that resonate with parents necessarily?
I think parents see how hard it is for people who don't have some kind of post-secondary training now, especially in this economic downturn. Like, we all know that if you don't have, I mean, we see what the unemployment rates are. We see that our kids who are newly out of high school and maybe take a year between high school and college cannot find a job almost every community, particularly if you're of color. But it's you know, you see those unemployment rates are like 25-30%. And I think that's very different than how it used to be. And in many communities, the burden of that is starting to be really felt by parents.
Okay, well, let's get into the content of the book here in terms of the advice you give to parents. Let's start with preschool. As you say, you have a whole chapter for parents thinking about looking at a preschool. So again, when you're talking about, say, middle class or affluent families, where do you come down in this kind of progressive versus traditional, play-based versus not, Waldorf, Montessori? What's your take? It seems like in the book you say you still need some pretty traditional things for your kids in preschool.
Yeah, I guess it, I mean, like in preschool, it seems like in most things in education, the devil's really in the details. Like my instinct as like a former hippie is to be like, hey, let every flower bloom and just let them play and the social skills. But actually having done the research into preschool and seen many, many preschools, I'm less enamored of that approach. I actually think that preschool teachers need to have an idea of what the building blocks of pre-literacy look like. They should know a little bit about the contemporary thinking on math cognition and how we learn math. And I'd like them to be, ideally, I'd like preschool teachers to have that knowledge and to be embedding that knowledge in a playful way. At the same time, I also have been in preschools in affluent areas that look like a scaled down version of fourth grade. And I think that's a really poor use of a 4-year-old's time.
Okay. You talk about testing in one chapter, and you try to get parents thinking about the use of test scores. What's your basic take on that? How useful are test scores for parents when making choices about schools?
You know, I'm not in the, like, I hate testing camp at all, because I'm actually one of the rare people who see that there was a strong value in No Child Left Behind. I mean, clearly it's worn down now and it's needs to be repaired. But to the extent that our focus on testing focused our nation's attention on the achievement gap between low income and middle income kids, I think was very good. And so I don't come from a we shouldn't test them. Standardized tests are the devil. I'm not coming from that place. But to my astonishment, when you actually talk to psychometricians, the people who develop tests, they're very cautious about what they believe we should be using these standardized tests for. And I tried to reflect that in my chapter, that they are very good instruments if you use them for what they're intended to be used for. But if we use them as a measurement of the quality of education our kids are getting, or how good a teacher is at delivering a teaching, I have grave doubts about that.
So you go on greatschools.net and you look for your school's rating, and that is driven entirely by test scores. So, you know, if your school is a 10, it means that, you know, that school is doing better than almost any other school in the state and getting all the kids to proficiency. I mean, should parents totally disregard that? Is that meaningless?
Not totally. My guidance, I guess, would be that it's a good jumping off point. It's a good place to begin asking questions to the principal on the school tour. For instance, you know, I sort of compare it to there's two things that, like a stock price. If your stock price is up, there's two things that could be happening. Either your company that you're thinking about investing your 401k in is doing fantastic. They've got, you know, the majority market share. They've cornered the natural resources and they have a slick and efficient way of producing the product, right? That's what it could be. Or it could be they fired all the workers. They are sitting on a bundle of cash because they're not buying any resources, raw materials to create this product. So which is it? You know, and that's the kind of two ways that schools, metaphorically, that schools can produce good test scores. They can teach to the test and they can shape their curriculum around those standards, or they can embed those standards in complexity. And so you need to ask questions of your principal. For instance, the simple question would be, okay, your test scores are up, or you have, you know, you're doing great according to how the state says you should be doing. What have you done as a pedagogic leader to create that advantage, to create that growth in your kids? And then listen for the answer. And then you'll know what kind of school, what kind of company that stock really reflects.
Interesting. You know, I was a little bit surprised that you didn't mention to parents just the issue of demographics and test scores, that if you're thinking about sending your child to a more diverse school, the test scores might be lower because we know that because of the achievement gap, poor and minority kids are performing worse. I mean, is that something important for parents to consider when they're looking at the test score issue? Isn't it true that test scores and demographics are closely linked? So the schools that are going to have the highest test scores in the nines or tens and great schools are largely going to be schools that are mostly white and affluent. Isn't that something that parents need to take into account, that you know, they might want a school that's more diverse and those test scores might be lower?
I think your question is an interesting one, because it considers that the parents' decision-making process is foremost has this idea that we want a diverse environment and a racially or economically diverse environment for our children. And in the research that I've seen in how parents choose schools, that is not the foremost consideration for parents. I think that low income I've been looking at the research at the University of Washington Center for Reinventing Public Schools, you know, because they've like really parsed what the research says about that. I didn't consider that, because I think that's sometimes what parents say about how they want to make choices for their kids, but the research shows that's not really the way they make choices for their kids around what schools to choose.
Fair enough. Class size. You seem to indicate that class size is not all it's cracked up to be.
Well, in a way, I still believe that class size is important. I actually would instinctually, as a parent, favor it. because largely I listen to what teachers say, since they are the frontline workers of education, that it's easier to even get to know your child, to have a rich relationship with your child in a smaller class size. I'm also aware of the big debate about class size that Michelle Rhee says you could add a few more teachers to a few more kids to excellent teachers' classrooms, and that would be a great way to deal with the budget crisis. And so I tried to like dig into what we actually know about class size and was interested to see that it seems very sensitive. Kids are very sensitive to class size from K until third grade, and then a little less so in terms of academic performance, and that class size is not necessarily the be-all and the end-all after third grade from what I could read. And then that's in terms of what I could tell in terms of academic performance, in terms of social and emotional development, which of course is very important to parents. There does seem to be the class size does seem to matter.
Okay, we're talking with Peg Tyer, the author of The Good School. We'll be back after this short break.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Back with Peg Tyer, the author of The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. Peg is joining us via Skype. Peg, we were just talking about smaller classes. Now let's talk about reading. You have a whole chapter in here about scientifically based reading, and you seem passionate about this, maybe even angry.
Angry? No, I'm not angry. I really care about reading. I see that, especially from the last book I wrote about boys, which is called Trouble with Boys, about the underachievement of boys, that in so many cases where kids fall off the beam academically is first around reading. And I see the numbers of kids who are reading proficiently in our country. I see that about a third of kids don't learn to read proficiently. And I've talked to enough scientists who work on reading cognition to, and they tell me that it doesn't have to be that way. And if you know what reading failure looks like in adults, it's so tragic. If you don't learn to read at grade level, by the time you're in third grade, it prefigures some very negative things for your child academically. And if you don't learn to read well by the time you're out of high school, it prefigures some grave outcomes for you as an adult. So I feel that it's like a public health issue, reading and reading proficiency. I care passionately about that, but I don't feel angry about it.
Well, do you think in this one there are sort of good guys and bad guys in the reading wars? What's your take on, you have a clear take on what good reading instruction looks like?
Well, my take is based on talking to people who work with, neuroscientists who basically don't have a lot of gray area in how they think people learn to read. Like, through scientific consensus and many, many, really 25 years of research, they pinpoint it very specifically. It's not like a theory that they have. They believe that they know. Not every tiny little lick and splatter, but they have consensus around how we learn to read, and that is our brain breaks down very quickly in a nanosecond, breaks down words into sounds and sort of, and then finds meaning and then processes that meaning. But when you go into classrooms, that way of understanding how we read is described by reading teachers as one theory. And if you go into teachers' colleges, many of them don't even touch upon actually how humans learn to read in reading instruction classes. And I find that to be a bewildering disconnect. And I think that it's kind of sad.
So what's a parent supposed to do about that?
One thing, I don't like to scare parents because there's plenty of people who will scare you with Chinese-made toys and conventionally grown strawberries and all marbles, all the horrors, electrical outlets that are uncovered, all the horrible things that you can do as a parent. But one of the things I really think is crucial, and I wish actually I had done as a parent, is to pay laser-like attention to my child's progress in reading and to ensure that they're on grade level. I think that you really can't stress that enough when you look at the downstream effects of reading failure. And you need to have conversations with your child's teacher, like, are they at grade level? And if not, you don't want to have a conversation like, he doesn't pay attention, or she seems adept at using glue. You want to have conversations about, like, what specific skills are they lacking, and what strategies can the teacher use? Can you reinforce at home? Can you get a supplementary education from the reading specialist to bring your child to those skills?
And how much is this about parents reading to the child, you know, from early ages? I mean, does that just set such an important context, or is this more about what happens in school?
From what I understand from the research, the more you read to a child, basically the better their outcome is going to be. And there doesn't seem to be, if you look at it like dose related, like reading to a child as a dose of like a vaccination for to prime them for reading success, there doesn't seem to be an upper limit on the dose. Like, you can read to them at night before they go to bed, but also in the morning's pretty good too. And maybe a couple of pages before lunch, not bad. Like, there doesn't seem to be like a point at which it's too much.
More is better.
And talking is great, and eliciting words is great, and rhyming is great, and rapping is great because it's rhyming and also rhythmic and sound. So anything that helps kids break down sentences into the beats of words and then the beats of syllables, the research seems fairly clear that that all helps them in the early stages of reading, which is kind of exciting that there's things that you can do to help them, you know, sort of prime them for success.
Well, my 4-year-old son is a big Dr. Seuss fan right now, so we're enjoying that. Absolutely. But you say something in the book which is interesting, which is that, you know, there are some concerns that parents today, even affluent parents, aren't talking to their kids as much as maybe parents were 10 or 20 years ago.
You know, it's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, but I see that parents hand children their iPhones when they're walking down the street and they're in the stroller, and that would seem to me to be in the past prime time for parents to be pointing out the dog and asking them what sound the dog makes and describing the stop sign and reinforcing the idea that signs have meaning and all those like critical building blocks of academic success, and the kids are toying with the apps on the iPhones. So that is a pet peeve of mine. I see a lot of silence at the playground because parents are on their Blackberries, where I once saw a lot of like verbal interaction. I have to say that does concern me a bit.
You write in a very interesting chapter on math about monkeys doing math. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh my God, I was so worried about this math chapter because I, of course, if I had good math skills, I would be, you know, on Wall Street and be making a ton of money. So I actually approached the math chapter with some trepidation, and I didn't know what I would write about math education. So I started calling the smartest people I knew in math education, and they steered me to these people who were working in math cognition. And I had the best time reporting this chapter. Oh my God, it was the most exciting thing for me. So it turns out that the way that math is taught in our country, I would argue, is about to undergo a pretty profound revolution because of what's happening in labs right now. And that is, neurocognitive scientists are looking at the way in which we have looking at sort of our undergirding for math ability. So that it turns out, like, just like we get phonemic awareness, which is the letter sound correspondence in our heads, it turns out that there's kind of like a rebar for math that is either innate or gets laid down really early that helps us reinforce these building blocks of math. And teachers now call it mental math. And it's the way that when you look at bananas in the grocery store and you try and figure out if you're going to need a lot of bananas or a little bananas, and then you choose the big bunch, like, that's mental math. Or when you're in the grocery store and you're trying to figure out how you get out of the grocery store quickly and you add up like the number of items in someone's cart and the length of the line, and you try and that's all mental math, right? So we all have this, and primates have it as well. Pigeons have it as well. Lots of animals have it. But scientists are starting to now think that, well, we know that infants have it, and they have it very, very early, and they have it at varying strengths. And so now the idea that these neurocognitive scientists are focusing on is, can we strengthen it, and how do we strengthen it, and what are the interventions that strengthen it over time? Because the stronger your mental math, the better you do in general in math. So it's like this innate ability that is being completely ignored in math education. And I'm super excited about what that's going to mean for math. The other thing that I discovered in my research on this chapter is that it was some old research from the 90s that pointed out the difference in attitudes that parents have in countries where children do well in math, as opposed to the United States, where kids don't do particularly well. And that is, they don't trash talk math. They don't talk about it like a singing voice either. They talk like a talent. They talk about math like a skill. And so nobody says, like, I'm bad at math, because that basically is a way of saying I'm a lazy person. They say math is a result of math. Ability is the result of working hard in math. And so if you don't do well in math, it just means you have to work harder at it, which is a totally different attitude than we have here, where we constantly tell our kids, like, oh, mommy doesn't balance her checkbook because she's bad at math, or your dad wasn't good at math, that's why your grades are bad. No. It would seem that those attitudes are undercutting our children's ability.
Fascinating. Okay, we're here with Peg Tyer, the author of The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. We'll be back in a minute.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Tyer, the author of The Good School. Peg, you talk about recess. This is something parents care an awful lot about, and concerns that recess is going away. Why is it so important?
Recess is going away, and I feel for school administrators who are taking it away, because they're operating through an interesting body of research that says the more direct instruction kids get, the better they do. At the same time, doctors tell us that in order for children to be at their cognitive peak, they have to have 20 minutes of recess a day and more. So the problem is that school administrators are torn between these two sort of competing bodies of research. One, you want children to do really well. And two, you also need them to take breaks to be at their cognitive peak. And I think unless parents make their presence felt, many school administrators are happy to shave recess, because also in the course of a school day, recess is a little bit of a hassle.
What do you mean? Why is it a hassle?
You know, getting the kids out, getting their boots on, they fall, they scrape their knees, then you have to hire a school nurse. It's expensive. It's chaotic. It's, you know, but it's also apparently vitally important to keep kids at their cognitive peak.
Okay. And then you also, of course, talk about teachers. And as those of us in the sort of policy research community know and explain this to parents, how important teachers are. You suggest that parents ask and find out where teachers went to college. And you say that's not snobby. That's just an important piece of information.
I was so uncomfortable writing that passage, but there is some research to suggest that if a teacher has an advanced degree in the subject that they're teaching, not in education, that they'll be a better, more effective teacher. And also, the more competitive the school that they went to, the better teacher they are. Doesn't that sound like just so classist and snobby? And I know, like, all my cousins who went rightly to the state school where they, you know, that's the school that they had access to, and our fantastic teachers are going to be giving me just a huge amount of crap about that at my next family reunion. But that's what the research says. Sorry.
Well, and that's because what? It's an indicator that competitiveness might be an indicator of general intelligence, verbal intelligence, to get into one of those competitive colleges, you had to score high in SAT, et cetera.
Right. But, you know, as a quick and dirty measure for parents, that might work. However, I'm aware of how it sounds, and I'll take a lot of, you know, heat for that.
Now, but what, you know, so you know as a parent that, okay, the quality of the teacher matters. I want the teacher to be smart, highly verbal, to care about the kids. But what do you do if you find yourself stuck with a bad teacher? I mean, parents don't get to choose their teachers.
That's very true. And I think it's especially true when you drop your child off at school and they have a first year teacher. And we know that first year teachers don't tend to be highly effective. So what do you do? Do you ask that your child be transferred out? And is that really acting in a civically responsible way? Because what if all 10, you know, 10 parents decide they want their kids to put pulled out of that teacher? I mean, everyone has to start their job somewhere. But it is a point, you, now you read the book, you know the research, you know that first-year teachers don't tend to be that effective. So I think that you could go to the principal and rightly say, look, I read this research. I know that first-year teachers aren't highly effective. So tell me, what are you doing to scaffold that teacher in their first year so that my child can move forward academically and it's not just the guinea pig for your new hire? Like, what are you doing to mentor that teacher? How do you bring them to best practices? And listen for the answer, because it what I see is that good schools grow good teachers and support good teachers. And while some of them are, you know, spring fully blown from whatever graduate school, many of them can be brought into the fold, can be brought up to a certain level with the right support. And I think it's important that parents make their feelings known to principals, that that is a priority for them, that they understand that good teachers are going to be important for their kids' lives.
You know, you hinted at this just a minute ago, Peg, this issue is sort of a social issue. If everybody pulls their kid out of that first-year teacher's classroom, I mean, some people say, look, you know, Peg's book's going to be read by affluent parents, advantaged parents. It's just going to give them even greater advantage in getting the best for their kid in what's a zero-sum system.
Yeah, you know, rich people do better in our society than poor people in healthcare, in education, in housing, in just about every reason, everything walk of life that you look at. But I think the reason I wrote my book is because I think it's super hard for parents of all walks of life to find unbiased information that's written in a way that's quality information, but it's written for parents and it's not academic or policy based. And so, even though I have kind of a reluctance to do sort of like service journalism, I felt that this was because all our school reform is based on this idea of school choice, and because parents are so much at sea on how to choose a school, I felt that this was useful. Is it a criticism that affluent parents are more likely to buy a book? I don't know. I mean, I'd like this book to be translated in Spanish and be available on the web, and that would be awesome. I invite people to use this information and translate it and put it on their websites in church or pass it out at church groups. I mean, I'd love it to be reach parents at all levels.
Okay. You title your last chapter The Perfect School. You seem to make a point that that is not the title of the book.
Why? Yeah. There is no perfect school, and that I wish there was one, because I would have laid out the blueprint and then I would have charged a lot more for the book. There's not going to be a perfect recipe that I can give parents for their child. Your child, your family is unique, and the goals of your family are unique, and what you want out of your child's education is unique. But I would say that the reason I wrote this book is if you want to send your child to a school, for instance, that doesn't use a program that doesn't use a research-based program for reading, okay? Now, you might really like other things about that school. It may square with your religious values. It may square with your social values. It may be the only school that you can get your child to and still get to your job on time, the job that keeps the roof over your family's head. And I appreciate all those factors. I'm not writing from Mount Olympus. I know that that each family has a kind of ecology, but my hope is that when you read this book and you read the research, you'll then know how much of a risk you're taking. Like, you'll be able to gauge better. It won't just be like a kind of a Hail Mary pass where you're like, God, I hope this works. You know, still raising a child is a Hail Mary pass. You're always in that state as a parent, but at least you'll be able to calculate a little better what the deficit is that you're bringing into your family and maybe make up for it a little bit in other ways.
So that you'll go into those choices fully aware and informed.
Oh, gosh, I wish we could all go into our choices as parents fully aware. If we did, I'm not sure we'd have kids, but at least to go in a little more aware and a little more informed.
Okay, great. I like that Hail Mary analogy. Peg Tyer, the author of The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. Thanks so much for joining us on the Education Next Book Club.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterman. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.